Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, the 15th of June, 1999, and the location of the fireside room in Koinonia this evening is the session by John Schramm and Ray McKeever for Men Only, But Women Are Welcome. Let's listen in.
Welcome. If you're here for the session for Men Only, Women, welcome too. You're at the right place.
If you want to be in the liturgical choir, that's next
door. That's next door. When I was born, I was given my father's name, McKeever's first boy, Raymond Benton the same. Ray Senior was he, Ray Junior for me, we would be two of a kind, for the whole world to see. Father's friends would come round, and they would shake both our hands. When your son grows up, he will be just like his old man, a chip off the old block. My dad, he would laugh with his friends, but we shared a secret so sweet, he even kept it from them. For he would call me Ramon, and his voice would be gentle and warm, with a softness in his eye and the brightness of a friend. And when he called me Ramon, I would feel so happy inside, filled with pride, for I was his son, and he called me Ramon. I'd like you to sing along on that chorus. There's a lot of words to it. So if you can only nail one word, you know which one it would be, okay? I grew up, made him proud, did the things that a young boy would do. I learned to play baseball, and even got some good grades at school. Cut the grass in the yard, helped him build our home. And I knew he was pleased with me when he called me Ramon. Yeah. Yes, he called me Ramon. And his voice would be gentle and warm, with a softness in his eye and the brightness of a friend. And when he called me Ramon, I would feel so happy inside, filled with pride, for I was his son, and he called me Ramon. Now I am a man, my father gets his retirement pay, I'm in my prime, he lives too far away, I don't see him enough. But whenever we talk on the phone, I still hear his love for me when he calls me Ramon. My father was a band director for 37 years. I got a lot of my music from him. And one of the things that I love most in my life is playing in musical ensembles. So in honor of my father and my love of that, could you please join the kazoo orchestra on this next chorus? All you gotta do is go, ready, here we go. My father dies, as all old men must do, no matter how wise and no matter how cruel. when he is reborn. And he finds a new home, then I will christen him, and I will call him Ramon. Here we go. Yes, I will call him Ramon. My voice will be gentle, and my voice will be gentle and warm, with a softness in my eye and the brightness of a friend. And when I call him Ramon, I will feel so happy inside, filled with pride, for I was his son, and he called me Ramon. Filled with pride, for I was his son, and he called me Ramon.
Thank you, Ray. Well, welcome to an evening of songs and stories. If you were here last night, welcome back. Tonight is a little different. Last night was something Ray and I had done before. Tonight, we've never done songs and stories about men and men's lives. In fact, this is more Ray's field than mine. For some years, he did men's issues, wrote songs for that. So last night, we had segues, whether you knew it or not. They did fit together last night, the story and the song. And tonight, it's more, I have some stories about men in my life, and Ray has some songs. You probably won't notice any difference from last night. And I decided what I would do is simply tell you about some men who have shaped me, who have given me an understanding of what it means to be a man, some of my mentors. Last night, if you were here, you know that all of my stories are true, and some of them also actually happened. Tonight, they all actually happened. They are stories in my life. So you can have that, if that's important to you. Some fundamentalists have to know whether that really did happen or not. My first story is who I learned from, my next door neighbor. I learned how men introduce themselves to one another. That's important. It's kind of awkward for men. If you were here last night, you know that we lived for a while at 1319 21st Street Northwest. That's near DuPont Circle. What I didn't tell you last night was the size of those homes. They are row houses. Ours was 19 feet wide. Your house was categorized in one of three classes. If you could hear your neighbors chewing celery, it was a low-class house. If you could not hear them chewing celery, but hear them flush the toilet, it was a middle-income house. And if you heard nothing from your neighbor's house, you were in a high-class house. We were in a middle-class house. I could hear the toilet flush, but I had never met the man. Being 19 feet wide, it means that our backyard was 19 feet wide and about 19 feet deep. It was a postage stamp. It was, it felt like it was about like this in the middle of the room when you went out. So the previous owner of our house had built a 6-foot fence between us and this neighbor, as yet unknown to me. And I walked out one morning and I heard someone say to me, "I hear you are a clergyman." And I turned it, all I could see, he wore glasses, all I could see was the top of his head and blinking eyes behind this pair of glasses, and he repeated, "I said, I hear you are a clergyman." And I said, yes, I'm a Lutheran pastor. He said, "I want you to know that I'm anti-clerical." And I said, "You know, I think I am too." And he didn't know what to do with that. So he said, "Well, I also want you to know that I'm a Unitarian. That says, I say there is at most one God." And I didn't know what to do with that. So he said, since neither of us was talking, "I also want you to know that I'm a lawyer, and I think it's terrible when preachers get into legal matters." And I said, "I want you to know I think it's worse when lawyers get into religious issues." And a hand came over the fence and he said, "Hi." With a big smile, and he said, "Hi, I'm Charlie." And we had a great 7 years as neighbors. The high point, you remember what kind of house we lived in? You could hear the toilet flush. You could hear Charlie's piano. We didn't need a stereo, we didn't need anything, and Charlie was a very good jazz pianist. It was not his primary vocation, but good enough that the best jazz spots in Georgetown, if someone didn't show up, could call Charlie and he could sit in with any group. He was really good. And can you imagine a neighbor who finds out that this preacher next door really does go to sleep by 11 or so? Always cut the music at 11, and the last thing of the day was, "A mighty fortress is our God."
I had a first grade teacher named Mary Schmidt, who I don't remember as well as you do, Charlie. But I do remember something about her and something that she did with a paper that I handed in to her, which I've never forgotten, and which has had a big impact on my life and my grappling with my own role and face in life as a male and a creative artist. So I sing this song. It's called "Make a Good Name." And this actually happened. I'd been told by my father, who had said, "If you follow the rules, you'll make a good name at Jefferson School." Mary Schmidt was the teacher, and I liked her a lot. She liked me too, and sometimes I even got to do her a favor, like erase the board. But even more than Mary, I adored Gay and Martin, Vicky and Mason, Carol and Robinson. Gay and Martin, Vicky and Mason, Carol and Robinson. There was some kind of magic in these three young girls, with their pleated little skirts and their long brown curls, and the way they colored pictures so bold and free, that must have touched something deep inside of me. Because one day I wrote my name, like Mrs. Schmidt said, in the upper right corner of my paper. But instead of Raymond Benton McKeever, I signed Ray Ann McKeever, and it looked just fine. Gay and Martin, Vicky and Mason, Caroline Robinson. Gay and Martin, Vicky and Mason, Caroline. The next day, Mary gave our papers back. She announced what I had done, and everybody laughed. And I felt so bad that I could have cried. But I swallowed my tears, and a part of me died. Thank you. Well, all this happened almost 50 years ago. Mary Schmidt is gone. God rest her soul. And please keep these women just as bold and free as the Ray and McKeever still living in me. Gay and Martin, Vicky and Mason, Carol and Robinson. Gay and Martin, Vicky and Mason, Carol and Robinson.
I'd like to pay tribute to a theological mentor. It was in the mid-70s, and I always thought that pacifism was probably the proper expression of the Christian faith, but it's very hard to be a pacifist in the Lutheran Church. You have to be in the closet a little bit. In fact, when I got bolder some years later, I wrote what I felt about that in print and said, in the Lutheran Church, we are pacifists between wars. It's like being a vegetarian between meals. And I didn't have a lot of support for my strong interest in nonviolence and peacemaking. There is more interest now. Part of the summer offerings go to a very fine organization called Lutheran Peace Fellowship. But two things came within 1 week. Stanley Hauerwas wrote, individual pacifists have sometimes been taken seriously, but pacifism as a mainstream Christian approach has never been taken seriously. That may well change with a new book. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And then I read in Fellowship Magazine, which is the magazine of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, that Jim Forrest, the editor, had a little item and said, I went on a retreat, and it was at Gethsemane Abbey, hosted by Thomas Merton, and he listed who was there, including Daniel Berrigan and some other names that blew me away. And his summary of the retreat was, the real highlight and the thing I remember was a Mennonite scholar, John Howard Yoder, who always brought us back to the cross. And I thought, if you went on a retreat with Thomas Merton, Daniel Berrigan, and a half a dozen other biggies, and remembered a Mennonite scholar who I didn't even know, he must be something. And I remembered, and it was the same book by the same author that Stanley Hauerwas had spoken about. So I got the book. I was living on a farm in West Virginia. And I was blown away. So I thought, well, I'm just not sophisticated enough theologically or biblically. So I sent the book to Larry Rasmussen and Walt Bowman and said, straighten me out here. I'm in trouble. And I got back from Walt Bowman. That's some of the only fresh stuff I've read in 5 years. And from Larry Rasmussen, I will never teach ethics the same again. I thought, well, we've got a book on our hands. So I arranged with Larry, and I read it at the farm, and then I would go in with my notes and my questions to Washington, D.C. It was a four-hour drive, and we'd spend an afternoon, and then I'd come back to the farm. But that book was very, very fundamental to my theology. So when we came to Holden, I think I've taught it here 10 times. There was a time when the staff would try to get me and say, what is the footnote on page 232? And usually, I was close. Yeah, I knew it that well. And Jim Forrest was right. Yoder always brings you back to the cross. Let me give you just an example of that. If you remember the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, if Dan Spencer's here, I should have said, it's page 60, Dan, what is that about? Oh, he is up there. Dan Spencer would, The Politics of Jesus, John Howard Yoder. Dan Spencer would probably be a very famous geologist today if it weren't for this book and a movie, Excuse Me, America, about Dom Elder Comrah. We changed the direction of Dan's life here, and it's okay. the disciples on the road to Emmaus, the quote that Yoder is using is, we thought he would bring the kingdom. We thought this was the Messiah. We had hoped that he was the one who would redeem Israel is not just one more testimony to the disciples' obtuse failure to get Jesus' real point. It is an eyewitness report of the way Jesus had been heard. Jesus' rebuke to the unseeing pair on the road to Emmaus was not that they had been looking for a kingdom and should not have been. Their fault is that, just like Peter at Caesarea Philippi, they were failing to see that the suffering of the Messiah is the inauguration of the kingdom. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and enter into his glory? Glory here cannot mean the ascension, which has not been recounted yet. In fact, it is not clearly described in Luke's gospel at all. Might it not then mean, as with the concept of exaltation in John's gospel, that the cross itself is seen as fulfilling the kingdom promise? Here at the cross is the man who loves his enemies, the man whose righteousness is greater than that of the Pharisees, who being rich became poor, who gives his robe to those who took his cloak, who prays for those who despitefully use him. The cross is not a detour or a hurdle on the way to the kingdom. It is not even the way to the kingdom. It is the kingdom come. If you want a summary of the politics of Jesus, it has two parts: servanthood that replaces domination, and forgiveness that absorbs hostility. That's Yoder over and over again. Now let me tell you a couple stories that are a little lighter about John. He was an austere Mennonite. It took us a while to loosen him up a little bit. Frankly, I think Lutheranism did it, and I think maybe a glass of wine at the staff party helped. But he was a delightful man and a very good teacher, and I can still remember we came out of a session where Sister Maria Augusta Neal had been presenting some stuff. It was excellent stuff. But someone, I forget, I think it was in this corner, was so offended and was so much more conservative than the good sister that he just took her on at the end and gave a very different approach. And she smiled and said, I understand what you said, and it was very clearly said, but you're wrong. And then she went on. And it was just beautiful. And I came out and John was up on the stone wall there at the coffee break. He was just fuming. He said, it takes a soft-spoken nun to get away with that. And what I didn't tell him, you know those times you wish you could go back? John, you've done that in that same room. Let me tell you what he did one time. He was presenting the New Testament and the politics of Jesus, and someone from the balcony said, Dr. Yoder, what about Reinhold Niebuhr's essay on why the Christian is not a pacifist? And John said, I think that is the most articulate, logical, clearly written essay I have ever read on why one should not follow Jesus. Not bad as an answer, if you're almost like a soft-spoken nun. John died about a year ago. I don't know how much effect he had other places. Let me tell you the highest compliment I ever got, and I'll end with that. He was giving a presentation at Augsburg College. It was to mostly Lutherans, but the community was invited. And it had been a long day, and someone asked him a question, and it was a fairly substantive part of what his premise was. And he looked at his watch and said, I think John Schramm can tell you what I say on that, and I think he'll do it more briefly. I think John would like this song.
Before there was earth or water or sky,
before there was how, or where, or why. Before there was woman, before there was man, before there was no, and before there was, oh, yes, I can. There was the Word. Then came creation, and then came the fall. Then came the flood, and then came the call. Then came the promise, and then came the land. Then came captivity, then came the wilderness band, and there was the Word. And the Word became flesh, and the Word became born. The Word became one of our own. Some called him Savior, some called him King, some called him the one who would change everything. Some called him Truth, and some called him Grace, some called him the Light to enlighten the whole human race. And there was the Word. And the Word became flesh, and the Word became born. The Word became one of our own.
That's one of your.
That's one of my own. I didn't know whether to say that or not. But
I'll say it.
Wherever falsehood is turned into right, and wherever blindness is turned into sight, wherever death is turned into birth, wherever warfare is turned into peace on this earth, there is the Word. And the Word became flesh, and the Word became bone, and the Word became one of our own. Yes, the Word became heart, and the Word became mind. The Word became one of our kind.
Well, I picked a winner last night when I mentioned Gerhard Frost. Someone came up and said, Gerhard Frost really straightened me out when I asked him where in the Bible it said, God helps those who help themselves. If you want to know where that is, bring it to Bible study tomorrow morning and ask Charlie what chapter and verse that is. And another lady had him as a teacher in Luther College. I had about three or four people come up. He's my image of gentle strength. I used to say, before I would read some of his poems, here's a man, and if you don't know him, I can introduce him with one incident and you'll get at least some idea of what he's like. He knew that he was very sick, and I'm going to call on Charlie Mays to tell you about the last week of his life, because Charlie was his pastor. But he knew he was very sick, and his bishop came to see him. And even bishops sometimes are without the really good, right words, because Lowell Erdahl, his bishop, started by saying, Gerhard, how are you? Well, I mean, I might do that, and you might do that, but anyway, that was all right with Gerhard. He said, Lowell, let me put it this way. I no longer take out three-year magazine subscriptions, but I still do buy green bananas. Do you get some sense of what he would be like? Charlie, tell us about the last week.
I was a student of Gerhard when I was at the seminary, and then when I became pastor at University Lutheran Church of Hope in Minneapolis, he and I, Vern, were members. And he had been sick throughout the winter and spring of 1987. And one afternoon, Thursday afternoon, about 5 o'clock, I got a call from my Vern and said, Charlie, we'd like to have you come. We just received bad news. And so I went over to their home, and when I came in, Gerhard said, we've just come back from the doctor, and they finally diagnosed that I had liver cancer. And then we started a conversation which will be in my memory until I have no memory. And the first thing he said, you know, I have very little time left to live, and I have 3 or 4 big projects that I'd like to do, I'd like to finish. Another thing he said, you know, as I come to the end of my life, the thing I grieve is the world that we're leaving our children. And those two kind of things, that was on a Thursday, and the family had decided that they would gather on the next Thursday to celebrate communion with Gerhard, and by Monday it was obvious that that wasn't going to work. So we, all of us gathered on Tuesday, and we used the communion set that his father had had. And we all gathered around, and Gerhard was somewhat in and out, and when we came to the Lord's Prayer, then again that thing was really deep, and many people really lived again for him. When his death came, I told Ivern, you know, this is a man whose stature in the church is such that anyone you like in the church could do his service. And she said, no, you're his pastor. And so I was deeply honored. And what I did for the funeral sermon was simply use Gerhard's Our Last Conversation.
Thanks, Charlie. What he told his family near the end was 2 things. Forgive everything, remember the best. I'd like to share 4 very short poems that give you some idea of why I'm nominating him as a masculine figure of gentle strength. Today I learned a lesson, the simplest kind of lesson, from a fruit jar lid. My first turn was wrong, but I was stubborn and I was strong. The second was more wrong because I was strong. And now it sticks. How sad to be strong and stubborn when you're wrong. And you know, part of the tree of life this summer should point us to the environment and things of wonder. We had that with an Abraham Heschel quote last night and with the atheist's wail last night. This is the way Gerhard speaks about awe and wonder. He had just received a box of crayons, a birthday gift, deluxe it was, with more than 70 colors, and he was so proud. Whenever he found an audience, he'd empty every crayon out, then separate the color families, extolling the beauty of each crayon. Once, when the process ended, he surprised a viewer by reaching for one special crayon, the periwinkle blue, and saying as he held it high, this one is so pretty that it makes my eyes wet. He didn't say it makes me cry. Young as he was, he knew the difference between grief and an encounter with the transcendent. And this one I dedicate to some theologians that I've met who were often wrong but never in doubt. Thank you. When your options are either to revise your beliefs or to reject a person, then look again. Any formula for living that is too cramped for the human situation cries for rethinking. Hardcover catechisms are a contradiction to our loose-leaf lives. And finally, he was a basketball player. That isn't why I picked him as a male image, because he was not a good basketball player. That's why I picked him as my male image. I remember a moment long ago in a small town restaurant. We had just played a basketball game, played away from home, and won. We were in a celebrative mood. I was 14 and not very good, nor was our team. This made victory sweeter still. As we crowded into a booth, I said, "We won!" Quick as the flash of a knife came the remembered words, "What do you mean, we? You didn't even play." I won't forget the words, or the one who spoke them. But I turned to other words, sounding in my soul. My Lord says, "Do this in remembrance of me." Baptized into the death of Christ, I die in him to rise again with no part in the victory. I'm still invited to say, "We won."
There came a time in my life where I realized that my father was a limited person, and I had to rethink some of my expectations of him. It was particularly, I had to deal with this particularly at a time where I was in quite a bit of pain myself, and realized that he had not modeled a way for me to deal with that, or that I couldn't call on him to help me with that. I tried a little bit, but he didn't have what I needed. This song I'm going to sing is a song that was a reflection on that at the time, and a way that I came to terms with it myself. It actually should be sung before Ramon, because Ramon then was the song that came a year or so later out of just total celebration of being the son of my father. But I had to go through this to get there. How deeply do you love me, Father? Is there more than you might show? I have never heard you say it. How am I to know? You've lived on my perimeter with words of praise or reprimand. Was this your way of loving me? Oh, how am I to understand? I've seen you working hard and long, providing for your family. Bread and meat and words of wisdom, is your love in them to see? I think I know, I think I see, I think you love me true. Still, I'd like to hear you say, I love you. How deeply do I love you, Father? Is there more than I might show? You have never heard me say it. How are you to know? The many times I've tried to earn your praise, conform to your command, was this my way of loving you? Oh,
how are you to understand? Now I am on the outside, knowing your responsibility, and bread and meat and words of wisdom, no, they're not enough for me. For words of love need speaking between a father and his son. And so I'd like to tell you now, I love you.
I made a promise last night that I would tell you how 1319 21st Street became the legal address of David Alexander Belford. I'm sure you've been just holding your breath, waiting for the story behind that. If you remember last night, there was a mustard seed over in the basement of the Church of the Pilgrims. If you weren't here, you should know that that was a hippie runaway ministry, and it was an open space, safe zone, and people came, and sometimes that Catholic Presbyterian Tom Murphy sent people our way. Well, the doorbell rang one night at supper time, and I opened the door. Now this is a teacher of mine, and I'm not going to make fun of him, but I do have to describe him. I thought it was the Mad Magazine character Me Worry. That was his face, and it was delightful, but it didn't take long to know that some of the wires were not connected right in his head. And it didn't take long to know that he didn't have really good hearing, but there he was, and he said, Reverend Schramm, he was one of the only people in all of my ministry who never called me anything but Reverend Schramm. Reverend Schramm, Reverend Murphy, said I could probably eat dinner here and maybe wash my clothes. And I said, sure, come in. So we got him going on the clothes washing, which was very much needed. And I told Mary, we'll have one more for supper. And he joined us at our supper table. And we began to be instructed by David Alexander Belford about his philosophy of life and his life generally. For instance, I believe that on almost every table in the United States, I probably could eat there and they still would all have enough to eat. And he said, I especially like to choose the homes of Christians. They somehow seem to feel good about feeding someone else. So he survived this way. That soon became clear. Our daughter, Kathy, was about 4 or 5. And fortunately, David never heard her, but it didn't take her long to turn and say, where did my daddy find you? David never heard that one. The main thing David wanted to talk about was his project. David was out to visit every county in the United States and to get a county map from the county courthouse and to bring those all together at one place so that it would be the best county map museum the world had ever had. And his request was, could our house be the depository for these county maps? David always had a suitcase and there was nothing in it but county maps. So we got the first suitcase full of maps, and David was off. We saw David about every 6 months. I still remember one phone call, and it was, would you accept a collect call from David Alexander Belford? And I said, oh yeah. He said, Reverend Schramm, I'm on the border between Illinois and Wisconsin, and I don't know whether to cover Wisconsin first and then Illinois, or Illinois first and then Wisconsin. Well, it was a pay call and I was paying for it. And I wasn't going to do any pastoral counseling. I said, David, it makes no difference as long as you cover them both completely. Thank you, Reverend Schramm. And I didn't see him for another 6 months. But the next time he came, he said, "Reverend Schramm, I get arrested for vagrancy because I have no permanent address. Could I use your home?" And I said, "I guess that'd be all right, David." So he got some kind of photo ID with 1319 21st Street as his legal address, and as far as I know, did not get arrested then for vagrancy after that. But the incidents that came, you just never knew what was going to come next. The little kids in our neighborhood, they knew. They were streetwise. They knocked on the door and they said, "Mr. Schramm, there's a policeman, kind of an undercover FBI secretive type, in a car behind your house." Well, I went out and there was a character reading a newspaper and trying to look not at all suspicious, so I knocked on the window. Sure enough, the kids were right. And I said, "May I help you?" And he said, "Is this the residence of David Alexander Belfort?" And I said, "Yes, but David isn't here." He said, "Well, he has threatened the life of the President of the United States. And when you see him, we need to talk to him." And I said, "Well, sounds very unlikely to me, but I will do what you're asking me to do." When David showed up, I said, "David, I think it's the FBI, but they're looking for you. Somebody is looking." "Oh, I've taken care of that, Reverend Schramm. I met the man, and I met him at a restaurant on Connecticut Avenue, and he bought the coffee. It's fine. Everything is fine." And I said, "Well, what is this about the threatening letter to the president?" He said, "I am really incensed about that, Reverend Schramm. I read that President Nixon said you couldn't even travel in this country anymore. It was so dangerous. And I wrote to him and I said, 'Mr. President, you do not have to be fearful. I have been in the county courthouses of 40 of the states in the United States. I travel all of the time, and I don't think you need to worry. I travel and I don't have a gun. Please don't worry, Mr. President.'" He said, "Now, was that a threatening letter?" And I said, "No, David, I think you are a sane reaction to an insane world. I think you were trying to be kind, and you happened to mention a gun." And I didn't tell him, "David, the way you write, and you're just always going to be characterized as somebody dangerous, and you're going to have to live with it, friend." Then I got a call from a congressman from Alabama. And he said, "Is this the home of David Alexander Belfort?" I said, "It's his residence, but he isn't here." He said, "Well, I have a suitcase of his." He said, a constituent from Alabama sent it to our office because we live in D.C. and the address is 1319 21st Street. And I said, "Leave it there, and when David comes, he will come to pick it up." About 6 months later, David showed up. I said, "David, there's a suitcase of yours at a congressman's office up on Capitol Hill." "Oh, wonderful," David said. And I said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "Well, it was terrible, Reverend Schramm. It was terrible. I was walking along. I had my suitcase. I stopped on the highway above this bridge. I went under the bridge to take a crap. I wasn't gone 5 minutes. I came up and the suitcase was gone." I said, "Well, somebody found it, David, and they sent it to the congressman." He said, "I think that's what our congressmen are for, Reverend Schramm." Let me tell you the most touching. When he came to town, he could always stay at a dorm at American University. And the reason was they all laughed at him. It was a lark for the university male students to have this character in their dorm. It was very clear from what he'd say. And he came and he said, "They're running me for campus king with my picture on posters, Reverend Schramm." He said, "Actually, they're making fun of me, but it seems to give them a lot of amusement, and it doesn't really hurt me a bit." And I thought, you're more compassionate than most people I know, David. He knew exactly what was going on. Well, he's gone. I don't know where. And when we sold the house, we took everything out, except we thought we ought to leave the next owner a surprise, and somebody has boxes of county maps.
Sophie. We'll change, John. Here
we go. I know. That's fine.
Here is the church. Here is the steeple. Open the door. See all the people. Everyone welcome. Everyone equal. Open the door. See the people. We are the women. And we are the men. We are the stranger. We are the friend. We are the walking. We are the lame. We are the different, we are the same.
One, two, three, four.
Here is the church, here is the steeple. Open the door, see all the people. Everyone welcome, everyone equal. Open the door, see the people. We are the young, and we are the old. We are the gentle, we are the bold. We are the sinner. We are the saint. We are what we are, and we are what we ain't. One, two, three, four. Here is the church. Here is the steeple. Open the door. See all the people. Everyone welcome. Everyone equal. Open the door. See the people. We are the straight. We are the gay. We are what we do, and we are what we say. We are the single, we are the wed, we are the hungry, we are the bread. One, two, three, four. Here is the church, here is the steeple. Open the door, see all the people. Everyone welcome, everyone equal. Open the door, see the people. We are the altar, we are the street, we are the hands. We are the feet, we are the wealthy, we are the poor, we are the steeple, and we are the door. One, two, three, four. Here is the church, here is the steeple. Open the door, see all the people. Everyone welcome, everyone equal. Open the door, see the people. Open the door, open the door, open the door, see the people.
Does that mean you're not going to do Erica?
I could maybe do that one. Do it last or something. Should I?
No, just do it.
Okay. Well, I just thought of that. It seemed like a nice follow-on to that story.
But I don't want to miss it. Because some people came thinking this would be more of a men's issue thing than it is. Erica Levine is great. Can you remember the words?
Oh, I think, I can remember the words. No, Erica Levine had a great wiring. When Erica Levine was 7 and a half, up to the doorstep Jason Medcalf, and he said, "Will you marry me, Erica Levine?" And Erica Levine said, "What do you mean?" "Well, my mother and my father said a fella ought to marry, and my father said his uncle, who is at my uncle Larry," said his brother, "who is my uncle Larry, never married. And he said, Uncle Larry is a dope. So will you marry me?" said Erica. "Nope." "My piano teacher's smart and she never had to marry. Your father may be right about your Uncle Larry, but not being married isn't what made him a dope. Don't ask me again, because my answer is nope." When Erica Levine was 17, she went to the prom with Joel Bernstein, and they danced by the light of the sparkling Bobby sock, because the theme of the prom was the history of rock. And on the way home, Joel kissed her at the door, and he said, "Do you know what that kiss was for?" And she said, "No, I don't, but you kissed just fine." And he said, "What it means is that you are mine." And she said, "No, I'm not," and she rushed inside. On the way home, Joel Bernstein cried. She cried too, but wrote a letter to Ms., saying, "This much I know, I am mine, not his." when Erica Levine was 23. Her lover said, Erica, marry me. This relationship is answering a basic need, and I'd like to have it legally guaranteed. For without your precious love, I would surely die. Why don't we make it legal, said Erica, why? Basic needs at your age should be met by you. I'm your lover, not your mother. Let's be careful what we do. If I should ever marry, I would marry to grow. Not for tradition or possession or protection, no. I love you, but your needs are a very different issue. Then he cried, and Erica handed him a tissue. When Erica was 30, she was talking with Lou, discussing and deciding what they wanted to do. When we marry, should we live at your place or mine? Yours is rent control, but mine is on the bus line. And they argued and they fought, and they finally didn't care. So they joined a small cooperative near Matthews Square. Their wedding was a simple one, they wanted it that way. They thought about a lot about the things that they would choose to say. I will live with you and love you, but I'll never call you mine. Then the judge pronounced them married, and everyone had wine. And a happy ever after life was not the kind they got, but they tended to be happy more often than not. Ballad of Erica Levine, actually, I think by the same person that wrote the Benny Miller song.
It sounds like that. Anyway, I didn't want this not to include Erica Levine. I just have one more story, and it's if you don't have enough friends that one of them can tell you the truth, you don't have enough friends. And I had one like that. He's still in Minneapolis, so we're separated. We were very, very different. He was a worker. And he didn't think I was. I mean, he was a roofer, and I didn't work. So we sometimes had some troubles about that. We'd be in downtown Minneapolis, and he'd point out all those tall buildings, and he would say, not one product comes out of there, nothing but numbers and paper. Nobody can wear anything that comes out of there, nobody can live in anything that comes out of there, and nobody can eat anything that comes out of there. Those buildings are a waste. It's just numbers. But we had a great time, and we were good friends. We had a mutual friend, and he had some problems. Mary and I tried to befriend him once in a while, and one of the things was he was a fairly good mechanic. He had some problems, I told you that. And when we went out of town, we left him the Volkswagen Rabbit and what it needed. And we came back, and he had lost the part that he bought, and he had put his bicycle inside the car when he went somewhere, and all the grease came off inside the back seat of the Rabbit. So I didn't have the car fixed. I owed the bill on the part, and I had a very greasy inside to my Rabbit. So I told my friend Stefan one time at a Wendy's lunch after we had gone swimming at the Blaisdell Y, I told him my story about the problems that I had had, and he looked at me and he said, "You damn liberals make me sick." In theory, you like to be an advocate for the underdog and for the poor. Of course he messed up. It's because he doesn't have his life all together. If he had his life all together, he could jet around and give speeches about the simple life and get paid for it. You like the idea of being for the poor, but you don't want to be with them. Now, the next time you like the idea about being married, or a parent, or the idea of being in a church, just think of Stefan. I'll add that friend that you don't have, maybe. I miss him. This is it.
This is it. Well, thank you, John, for those stories. We haven't done this before, and I think we should do it again, because I love hearing your stories. They were great.
I like your songs.
I know you do. You heard my song. Just trying to open some conversation between us. The last song that we decided we'd do here is a song actually that I wrote about, going to be that long ago, 20 years ago, for a daughter, my other daughter, who's 28. And it's got a chorus that I think says a lot about just kind of breaking open what we're trying to be on about here, just touch on some things that might break and open something between people. Conversation starters, shared experiences, the focus is kind of helping men do that, but everybody. This is what happened. I had a little conversation with my daughter one night. She's probably 8 or 9 years old, and this is what came out of it. Please join me on the chorus when it comes around after you've heard it. The night is gently falling on the happy times we've had today. I brought your glass of water once again. Before I tuck you in and say goodnight, I love you. Is there anything you'd like to talk about or ask of me, my daughter? You're looking worried. Tell me, what's it all about? Is it something that the kids have said at school? Did they scare you in their ignorance, or did they hurt you in their pride? Did they laugh at you? Did they make you feel the fool? You can't tell me. You can't tell me. You can't tell me. I won't laugh at you. You can't tell me, you can't tell me, you can't tell me, I won't laugh at you. What's that you say? It's not any of the things I mentioned. They said something else that's got your attention, and you think I'll think you're silly if you say it. I don't think that I will think you're silly. I've heard a lot of silly statements in my time. I expect that I'll be hearing more. So the kids are saying the world will end in 1984, and Minneapolis will have a war next year. And you're thinking maybe we could move to England before then, because they've had their war, so they'll not have one again. You can't tell me. You can't tell me. You can't tell me. I won't laugh at you. You can't tell me. You can't tell me. You can't tell me. I won't laugh at you. I'm listening. You want to know if there are really bombs so big that they could kill the people high up on the hill at the same time folks are dying in the valley. Oh, why the men with guns would come and roam the streets where children run, hide in alleys, up on roofs, shoot at anything that moves. I don't know what to say when you ask me why there's war. I've never heard a reason I believe in. And if you're feeling frightened, I'm not surprised. Of course, I'll hold you while you go to sleep. Now rest your eyes, you're oh so wise. You can tell me. You can tell me, you can tell me, I won't laugh at you. You can tell me, you can tell me.
Very much. You've been great to be the listeners tonight and to join us in this circle. Tomorrow afternoon, Mary and Ray do some songs and stories about grace, and Thursday night, Ray and I have our final session with some songs and stories about simplicity. Go in peace.